Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara, it's your Chantress of Everything Valuable and Beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. I have the pleasure of speaking with Ilona Sari, who is described as a Renaissance woman, and we'll understand a little bit more about what that means. But Ilona has written a book that caught my interest. It's called The Wrong Station. And I thought, oh, how interesting that is, because, you know, we're on the wrong station, all right, Richard? So I thought, okay, let's talk about this book, The Wrong Station. And it's a mystery, but it's a mystery with a difference, because it happens at the wrong place at the wrong times, as so many, you know, tragedies in life. There's murder, spies, politics, romance, and food, because Ilona does a food blog. She's a writer. She's a very talented humorist as well. And she writes about New York City in this novel. And I want to just introduce Ilona by saying that she was also a former deputy press secretary for President Jimmy Carter. And how interesting is that? Because October 1st is Jimmy Carter's 100th birthday. And I thought we'd talk a little bit about her her relevance as the press secretary for President Carter. Anyway, the book information is, if you're interested, it's available on Amazon as well as we talk about this. But this is part of Ilona's series, Mystery Chronicles of New York Women. So first of all, I want to know what the Mystery Chronicles of New York Women is about. The first novel was called Freeze Frame, and then the next novel was White Gloves and Rob Roy's, and now we have The Wrong Station. And so, Ilona, first, what's your relationship with New York?
I'm a New Yorker. I'm a transplant to California, but I am a native New Yorker, and I grew up in Queens. Which this novel, The Wrong Station, half of it takes place in Queens. But I lived in Manhattan for 20 years, and it's in my heart. And no matter how far away I go or how long I'm gone, I'm still a New Yorker. There's even a little bit of accent, if you can hear it a little. I haven't gotten rid of it.
Totally. Yes, totally, totally. Yeah, totally. And so the book takes place in New York, and the city becomes a flavor in the book. So, you know, as a writer, how do you incorporate the city as a character?
Well, the city as a character is a character for me. It was when I was, growing up. It was when I was living in Manhattan, especially, and working in Manhattan, being a writer and also working in television. I could walk New York City streets in the middle of the night, never be afraid. If you know how to New York, walk in the New York streets, and it's magical. It's just a magical place for me. I'm not a nature lover, even though I'm now living in Ojai Valley, which is very rural. But nature to me is skyscrapers, lights in the windows at night, the bridges, people walking on the streets, and potted plants. That's nature's for me. And writing about New York and putting then my characters in New York is like one of my greatest pleasures. I just want to make my characters love New York the way I do. And hopefully my readers do as well.
So here's my experience with New York. So my grandfather and grandmother immigrated to New York. Actually, they met in New York City, in the German area of town at the time, in the 1920s. And there was a restaurant named Luchow's.
Oh gosh, yes.
Yeah, okay. So my grandfather worked there. Uh-huh. And so when he first came over, he worked there. And of course it was a lot of Germans.
Yes.
And the German cuisine. Are you, you're familiar with the restaurant,
Oh,
Elena?
Yes. Yes. I've eaten there often back in the day when I was still in Manhattan.
So he actually bought some property in the Bronx, my grandfather, and started a factory in the Bronx underneath Yankee Stadium, right kind of across the street from Yankee Stadium. And he owned a lot of property in that area. And so I knew the Bronx, and growing up when we'd go to visit, the Bronx was not a nice place to be. But, you know, over the years, the city has changed so much. Now, my brother and sister moved back to New York. We were raised in Chicago, but they both moved back. One moved back right next to the, you know, the Dakota where John Lennon had his apartment.
Yeah.
And my brother bought an apartment very close by there. And my sister bought an apartment in Hoboken. And all their kids live in the city now, too. It's so interesting because, you know, we didn't grow up in New York. My mother did. But then my mother and dad moved to Chicago. And we did not have anything to do with New York. And somehow it really called everybody pretty much in my family but me back. And so there's a real pull. The city has a real pull. And as you say, it becomes a character. So tell me about, really, I'm so interested to hear about your tenure as Deputy Press Secretary for President Jimmy Carter. How did you get that gig? What did you think of President Carter? What was your role? I know we're here to talk about the book, but I can't resist having just come off the heels of the Democratic Convention. Tell me about that time in your life.
First of all, I think it was probably the job that I loved the most. The man was a remarkable man. Is a remarkable man. He is what he appears to be, and that's unusual. He's honest. He's straightforward. He's also quite brilliant. And consequently, that was a problem for him because he couldn't compromise because he knew he was always right. And basically he was. But how I got the job, I worked in politics on and off while I was writing and working in TV. Every time I found a candidate that I really wanted to work for, I first would volunteer and I would end up doing press because of my background. And so I started with Mayor Lindsay when he was a Republican and I was only a mere child. And then as a Democrat, I worked for him both times when he was mayor. Then from there, I worked for Javits and Keating, senators from New York, and did, you know, I just during their campaigns or freelance. But so, I'd been writing. And then I moved to Chicago for a year in 1968, just before the convention, got arrested twice. And that was an experience. And then back in New York, I really decided that I was single by then. I had a starter marriage, as I call it, starter husband. I decided that I wanted to meet people besides the people that I had known all my life. And one of the things you do is you volunteer to places that even if you don't meet people that you like, you're doing something that you enjoy. And I did. And so I ended up, so I volunteered for the campaign in 76 and then worked for him on and off after that in doing press. And then it culminated in 1980 when he lost the convention. And he had promised, well, not he, but Jody Powell had promised me a press job at the UN, which was right down the block from my apartment. And I thought, oh, how fabulous. But then, but he lost. So no job at the UN. And I went back to just, you know, working. I worked in rock and roll. I was a rock and roll writer for a while. And I still did some political pieces. And then I really started in television and had a longer television career.
Well, when we get back from the break, I'd love to hear more about the television career as well. But you say that Jimmy Carter was exactly how he read. In other words, he was straightforward and honest, and there was no kind of public face. There was only who he was.
Exactly.
How about Rosalind? Did you know her?
I really didn't know Rosalind very well, but I did meet her when she came to New York. See, I was a deputy press secretary in New York. So basically Governor Cuomo was my boss. And there was a press secretary whose name, Ellis Woodard, was my boss in the New York City office, but I was deputy press secretary for the whole state. So I also dealt with Mario Cuomo. And I just did, a few spots with Jimmy Carter. When he came to New York to do this St. Patty's Day parade, when he did a town hall on Long Island, and it was back during mimeograph times, when you would send things to Washington, D.C. through that, whatever that was called back then, and they would do that back when I was writing press releases and so forth. So I got to know him. I'm sorry.
Yeah. How interesting. You know, and also I would like to talk a little bit about your TV career as well. I have a little bit of information, but I'd love more. So reintroducing, I'm talking with Ilona Sari, and Ilona has written a book that is super interesting, a mystery book. I think it's third in her series of Mystery Chronicles of New York Women. This is called The Wrong Station, where you've got murders and spies and politics and romance, and everything happens at the wrong place at the wrong time. It's clever. And if you're interested in New York and you like reading about things that happen, a noir kind of novel in New York City, this is the novel for you. Ilona was deputy press secretary for President Jimmy Carter and a notable TV personality as well. So we get back. We'll talk a little bit about that. And Ilona joins us from Ojai, of all places, being an urbanite.
That's true.
She's in Ojai. Don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I'm speaking with Ilona Sari, and this is a book called The Wrong Station, where Lorna Raven, a seasoned videographer, finds herself mired in a freakish plot involving two dead bodies, Russian agents, a Vogue ATF operator, and murders bent on killing her to protect their identity. And also, you've got a love interest in here as well. And the whole thing is set against a backdrop of urban danger in New York City. And we find out that Ilona was born and raised in Queens and is a native New Yorker and has a deep relationship with New York City. We talked a little bit about her job and tenure as deputy press secretary for President Jimmy Carter. Very prescient today because October 1st, President Carter turns 100. How wonderful is that? And she also wrote for the New York Daily News and many other important publications. I want to talk a little bit about her TV career. Ilona, tell me a little about your television career.
I was a writer, freelance writer in television when freelance writers actually were hired. Now everything is usually one or two writers for a series. But they would, back in the day, they would hire 5 or 6 episodes out of the 23 that the season used to be, freelancers. And so I went from documentary to a magazine show to a sitcom, whatever paid the rent. And my husband, Richard Camp, whom you've met over the years, was my co-writer and partner, and it was fun. But we had to move out of New York because there was little to no work in New York. All the TV business had moved, to LA. So we moved to LA in 1985, and there I was in the biggest suburban city in the country. It's not quite New York.
Right. Yes. And so what TV shows were you associated with?
I worked on documentaries, but the one sitcom that I wrote for was a sitcom called, Down to Earth. and it was a TBS sitcom, and that was fun. It had nobody that we know starring in it, but it lasted a year, and that was great. And then I, like one does in Hollywood, you write spec scripts, movie scripts. We had my first book, Freeze Frame, was originally a script, and it was optioned a dozen times, but never went. It always came back to me. The options would run out. And when we were on strike at one of our many strikes, the writer's strike, I decided to turn it into a novel. And as a novel, and that was the first Lorna Raven book. The Wrong Station is a sequel. And I'm a Stu Grafton fan. I love Spencer novels. I loved Nancy Drew as a kid. So I always wanted to write a sequel to Freeze Frame, and then I finally got around to it because in Ohio, there's not a lot to do, so I write a lot. I love it here, but, you know, it's quiet.
And, right.
Yeah.
Right. So also now, tell me a little bit about your food blog, My Dinners with Richard.
Oh, that's, I love to eat, unfortunately. I like to eat the wrong things. I'm also a junk food junkie, as is my heroine, Lorna. But I also love, fine food and good cuisine. So my husband, during our tenure in LA, learned how to cook, found it as a hobby and became a really phenomenal cook. And so I decided that because I loved what he was making, to start a blog. When the Julia Childs thing was happening and the Julia and her blog started, I thought, okay, well, I can do that. And so it became a fun project for me to write about Richard's dinner. But then I became a food critic, and then I reviewed wineries and restaurants, and it just mushroomed from there. But I also then put in memoir pieces. I put in funny Hollywood stories there, and that mushroomed into my writing for Huffington Post for a while, which was great. But it was another thing that didn't pay, so I still had to work in television. But finally, television is a kind of an ageist thing for actors and for writers. And when I felt I was starting to age out, that's when I turned to writing novels, and I prefer writing prose. It's more fun. I can do whatever I want. I don't have to listen to a producer or director and the limitations or the time. If it's TV, you have to do 23 minutes. If it's a half hour and all of that. So it's been wonderful. And it's so far been a nice little living. So I hope this third book, because it is a sequel to Freeze Frame, which was popular, will do well. And
so also you actually have had experiences with Richard as well. I interviewed Richard on the air not too long ago, your husband, regarding his latest book about the devil in My Neighbor. And boy, that was an interesting interview as well.
That's a different Richard.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, my Richard is a playwright and a theater director.
And oh, right.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And he was an artistic director for the Ojai Art Center here.
That's right. Okay. That's exactly. Yes. I saw him for a brief minute.
Yes.
I apologize for that. Absolutely. Oh, that's okay. Your Richard is extremely talented. Okay. So Richard, my Richard, Richard Dugan is there. We go to quick break, Richard, and I want to reintroduce. I'm speaking with Ilona Sari, a very interesting person who has written a new book, The Wrong Station, former deputy press secretary for President Jimmy Carter. Long television career, long career as a food writer and a wine writer, and now she's starting a series of novels with this, one of the central characters being New York City. The novels start with Freeze Frame, the mystery chronicle of New York women, White Gloves and Rob Roy is it's her next novel, and now we're talking about her new novel, The Wrong Station, which has just been released on well, 2 days ago, actually, was released.
Yes, and it just became number one on the Amazon ebook list for female detective stories or whatever. I forget exactly what the category was, but it's number one. So that made
That is fantastic. Hey, Richard, let's go to quick break. When we get back from the break, I want to talk just a little bit more. Alana mentioned a really interesting thing that she was a screenwriter and a television freelance writer in Los Angeles for many, many years. And she mentioned that she kind of retired and went into novel writing because she felt that Hollywood has an ageism thing, is what she said. I'd like to hear more about that. I've heard that from a number of people as well.
Yes.
So I'd like to hear more about that. And Alana is with us till the bottom of the hour. And then I'm going to introduce you to a fantastic old friend of mine who's up to all kinds of wonderful things. Tam Hunt is with us for the next part of the hour. So don't turn that down. Be back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Studer. I'm speaking with Ilona Sari, well, described as a Renaissance woman, and we're finding out why. Her new novel, The Wrong Station, she just told me it's made first on the Amazon ebook female mystery genre. How fantastic is that? And it's only been out 2 days. So that's wonderful. It's fantastic, Ilona. So tell me, okay, I want to know just very quickly about this ageism thing that you're talking about. I've heard it exists as well.
Yeah, it does. Even for men, at a certain age as a writer, the theory for the young development people in Hollywood, which I probably be babysat for at one point, is that at a certain age, we don't have the thumb on what's happening anymore. And so consequently, they keep looking for younger and younger writers, no matter what your credits are. There was a lawsuit some years ago before we moved to Ojai, doing exactly that, suing the ageism thing. And we all the writers that were in the union and were not hired of a certain age, we all got a little bit of money. So that was kind of fun. But that's when I turned to novel writing, because nobody cares what I look like or how old I am. Especially since my heroine is only 30.
I get it. Okay, I get it. So I just want to do another little quick shout out. Tell everyone how to get the book.
You can get the book on Barnes & Noble online or Amazon. And or you can come to my book signing in Ventura this on September 14th between 1 and 3 p.m. at Barnes & Noble. Since I wanted to push that because you're a Santa Barbara station and maybe some Santa Barbara people might want to drive to Ventura, to Barnes & Noble and meet me. It would be fun. But there's really, basically, it's just Barnes & Noble online and Amazon, though Barnes & Noble probably will be carrying the book as well because it's an independent book.
Excellent. And how do people get in touch with you?
With me? Oh, my website is ElonaJoySari.com. And I also have a Facebook authors page, so they can get in touch with me there, ElonaJoySari.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to reading the book. It just came out 2 days ago, and it's already made top on Amazon's female mystery writers list. That's fantastic. Thank you. Ilona, thanks for being with us. And hey, Richard, I want to go to a quick break, and then I want to introduce Tam. And Tam, it's so good to see you, even though it's Zoom. Don't turn
that
down.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Bye-bye.
Welcome back, and this is a real treat for me. I have known Tam Hunt since, I think it was 2012. We both were studying at the same coffee shop, and there was this handsome person, and I had to get to know him, and we actually ended up talking about starting something called The Salon, and The Salon has been going on for 11 years in fits and starts. But we're having another salon this Sunday. And I thought, Tam's life is so interesting, and he's such an accomplished thinker that I thought I'd ask him to come and just tell us what he's been up to lately. And Tam has a couple of homes. He's just flown in 2 days ago from his home in Hawaii, and surprisingly is not jet lagged. And so here's Tam. And Tam, start me off. What are you doing community-wise these days?
Yeah, great to see you again. And I love that you're still doing the show. And I think it was, 10 years ago when I was first on the show? So
that's right.
Happy to be here and kind of update on what I've been doing. And also, I looked back at the writing I was doing 10 years ago that inspired my coming on your show the first time. And it's kind of fun to read, you know, your own stuff from a while ago. And sometimes when you do that, you may shake your head and go, oh my God, what was I thinking? Other times you say, wow, that's actually not bad. And today, I was like, wow, it's actually not bad, Tam. Good job. Good job, young Tam. So to answer your question, what am I doing nowadays? I have been living now full-time in Hawaii for 7 years. And I come back to Santa Barbara probably twice a year. A lot of friends here still. I'm still at UC Santa Barbara academically. And, you know, lots of reasons to be here. I'm actually here right now because I'm going to Burning Man, that little art festival in the desert, for my 10th time. Which is kind of ridiculous, but here I am. And, you know, I'll fill you in what I've been doing that relates to, you know, what you talk about, what you do for a living. I have been increasingly serious, air quotes, as a scholar in studying consciousness and neuroscience, which is kind of funny for someone who is actually a lawyer by day, but I've said now for many years, lawyer by day, philosopher by night. And I've now kind of gone beyond being a mere philosopher to actually publishing in neuroscience, which again is kind of strange, but it is true. And I recently finished a 3-year stint as lead editor for a journal called The Frontiers in Human Neuroscience, where we published a collection of 15 papers looking at a very interesting new niche in neuroscience called electromagnetic field theories of consciousness. And this is basically an approach that says, look, it's not all about synapses firing, bing, 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 bing. It's actually a lot more about the ambient field created by our neurons and our brain. And that ambient field, which pervades your brain and even goes outside your brain and your skull. For example, when you measure EEG with a skull cap, with electrodes on your scalp, you're measuring that electric field that your brain produces. We are suggesting in our work, because our theory, which I'll tell you about in a minute, of consciousness is a type of EM field theory. And we say that field actually is consciousness. So it's not that we're saying it's part of it. It's not that it produces it. We're saying that field is actually conscious, and it's the physical field that is our conscious self. So we're kind of fleshing out that work in neuroscience and philosophy. And that stems all from my work in philosophy that I talked with you about a decade ago on our theory of beauty, a theory of art, and trying to flesh out what I called back then a science of beauty.
That's right. That was the first thing that we talked about 10 years ago, the science of beauty. And I remember our mutual love of guest on Bachelard and a number of other writers, et cetera. And this is so interesting that you say that consciousness is that expansive field. I've always thought that was probably the case, because you know how you can, even the plebeian stuff, Tam, like you can feel another person. You can actually when someone's looking at you, even though you're not seeing them. You just know, you have a feeling. And I know Richard would be interested in this as well, because he talks a lot about this fact of life, that you know there is beyond our little bodies here, there's so much more. And a lot of philosophers have spoken about this, and you know, for example, even somebody like Jung has said there's something that expands that's part of you, but it's collective you as well. So you have the collective consciousness. Richard, you were about to say something.
No, I find this conversation fascinating, especially because that's one of the main questions. What is it? What is consciousness? And then, of course, the next question is, and where is it? There was a documentary on death and dying some years ago on PBS, where they got the permission, obviously, of the terminal person. They placed them on this large, it's kind of like one of those slabs, if you will, like in the morgue, but it also was a scale. And, of course, given permission and everything. And the body weight changed when the body died. It lost, like, I don't know, an eighth or a 16th of a pound, something very minuscule. And it's like, what happened? Because nothing left the table. Nothing left the body physically. So what left? I'm curious if you've done any research in that regard as to, I mean, you've just kind of talked about, you know, the force. I know Lynn McTaggart talks about the force, you know, and so forth.
The field, yeah.
The field, right. Has there been any research in that regard as to this aspect of our being? I think of it, if you remember the scene in Men in Black, where they've got this alien laying out on the slab and the head opens up and there's this tiny little guy inside, right? Remember that? And I'm thinking, that's sort of like our consciousness. That's how I used to think as a kid, that I'm looking out these eyes at the rest of the world that's here for me. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So there's different notions of the field, and the field we're talking about is a physical field. So the electromagnetic field is physical. It's not controversial. It simply is something measurable. It's something that all biology produces. We're saying that is consciousness. And it's a nested hierarchy of complex EM fields produced from the molecular to the whole body level. That's what I mean by a nested hierarchy. In terms of what you mentioned about body weight changing at death, I don't know about that. I find that probably unlikely, but not having seen the study, if there was a study, I can't really opine on that. But there is definitely, I think, here a lot of interesting crossovers in terms of thinking about psi phenomena, what are called paranormal phenomena, where certainly this notion of consciousness does leave space for things like telepathy or even telekinesis, because we are all in this larger field. It's not just our body and our brain. It's actually a field that pervades all the universe. literally, and it's just attenuated in different areas. And so it really is a question of how much information can be shared from here over there. And it does allow for a physical, not woo-woo notions of things like telepathy. Am I saying all the data on telepathy is true? No, I'm just saying this provides a mechanism for whereby things like telepathy or even telekinesis could indeed happen. But, you know, again, it's not meant to be, not meant to open up the gates for everything that we can imagine to be true. It's meant to provide a more comprehensive notion of what is awareness, what is consciousness, where is consciousness. That is actually the title of a paper we've written. So for us, it is in the field that our body brain produces in each moment. So right now, I am and you are this vast nested hierarchy of EM fields interacting.
I think that's fantastic. I would like to know, Richard, go ahead. I interrupt you. Go ahead, Richard.
I wanted to touch on this just real quickly. You know, you talk about, you know, it's like, where does it go? There are those who are of the mind that, of the mindset that, or the belief, I should say, there's nothing after this. Lights out. And of course, if it is lights out, we're never going to know anyway. But there are those, of course, who believe that, you know, our soul, our consciousness is eternal. And I don't know if those are diametrically opposed or if those are the same, consciousness and soul. What's your take on that?
Well, so these are deep topics, and I'll give you kind of my brief answer. So I've been dating a woman lately who is actually a tattoo artist, and she's kind of a philosopher slash artist. And, you know, I've written some books. She's read one of them. And it's prompted some discussions on notions of soul and afterlife and reincarnation. And I write in the book that she read that, look, you know, my personal view at this point in my personal evolution is that I don't see much evidence for the notion of the soul as an essential, you know, identity that is kind of given to you or comes into your body and then leaves at death. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying I don't see evidence of it personally. We have, though, she and I have talked about this notion of, well, maybe it's not that traditional, maybe a Christian notion of soul, but perhaps it is an evolving self that is you that may, in theory, be transferable in some manner. And that I would not disagree with. I think, you know, if you could, and so this is where it gets quite interesting, if you could create a nested hierarchy of EM fields artificially that in every way emulates the nested hierarchy of EM fields that is you or me right now, mm-hmm. then is there reason to believe that stimulation or emulation would not be exactly the same as you? And this gives rise to ideas of like uploading consciousness to the cloud, that kind of thing. Under the current computing model, this is where it gets quite interesting. The current computing model is called the von Neumann architecture. This is the basic way all computers today work. They're logic gates, and they specifically damp the EM field interactions across circuits because they want to have very clear logic gates and information being channeled through logic gates only. That is a specific dampening of these ambient nested hierarchies I'm talking about. So if we were to upload, quote unquote, you to the cloud mm-hmm. by mapping your brain in every way, that upload would have no conscious awareness. It might sound like you in its production of speech, like today's LLMs, you know, the AI LLMs, but it would not have any actual awareness. So what we'd be doing in uploading you is creating a zombie. So you become a zombie. And if we all upload ourselves to the cloud in a way, well, oh, I'm uploaded now, I'm immortal. What you've done is you've taken away what is essentially you, which is your conscious awareness. Mm. But if we instead create computers that operate on nested EM fields, then those computers and your upload would in fact be conscious.
I'll need you to draw me a diagram, but that'll have to wait. Elizabeth, we're close to another break here.
Okay. You know, what's so interesting, it's fascinating. I mean, it's just so refreshing to hear from Tim, his new thoughts and what world he's in now, which is so interesting. So, you know, Richard, what I was gathering from that just very quickly is, you can kind of prove Richardness by the negation of Richard.
So, one way of looking at it, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so that's what I was gathering from that comment. You know, the other thing I want to talk about very quickly is how people can get a hold of Tam's writings and Tam's books and Tam's thoughts. Richard's giving us a quick cue. We got to go to quick break. But when we get back from the break, let's talk a little bit about how we can do that. Don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Welcome back. I'm talking with an old friend, Tam Hunt, author and thinker and academic. You know, you're still at UCSB in the Consciousness Institute.
I am. Yeah. Yeah. I'm with Jonathan Schuller's lab. It's called the Meta Lab.
Yes.
And, yeah. Basically, Jonathan is a psychologist. I'm a philosopher playing at being a neuroscientist who is actually a lawyer by day. So it's all quite interesting and fun. But here we are.
And Jonathan is still there and he's doing well.
He is. Yeah, he's doing great. He's now a distinguished professor, which is the highest level you can get to at UCSB.
Oh, that's fantastic. So, Tam, tell people how they can get in touch with you and your writings. And do you have obviously you're the editor of a very famous magazine. So how can people get in touch? Tell us all those details.
Yeah, so tam-hunt.com is my website. And we're adding to that all the time. You can add me on LinkedIn, Tam Hunt on Amazon, for my books. I'm beginning a new podcast called Diamond Mind with Tam Hunt. There's only one episode released right now, but I'm going to release like another dozen in the next month or two. Been kind of working on it for a while, and we're kind of ramping up the rollout. Yeah, so I think that's enough right there. You know, I did want to also add, Liz, you know, in relation to art and your work, you know, I have not been, you know, sitting on my laurels in Hawaii. I've been quite busy there. And the reason I'm there is, you know, manyfold, but a big reason is that it is surprisingly cheap where I live in Hawaii, on the Big Island. I live down not too far from the volcano. The volcano keeps it very vital and creative and also quite cheap because people are like, hey, there's a volcano. It can actually erupt anytime. And it does. I lost a house back in 2018 to the volcano, but I bought another house not too far away. And because it is cheap, you can actually build, you know, beautiful structures and homes a lot cheaper than in a place, say, like Santa Barbara, which is famously very expensive. So I've recently finished a two-story temple structure called Lakahi Temple, which is made all with local materials. And what I'm really enjoying doing is working on what I call grown art. So you probably know the term found art. Of course you do, where you might find a beautiful piece of driftwood and incorporate it into a sculpture. Grown art is where you work with the landscape, and in this case with the jungle, to create something that over time will grow into something even more beautiful. So this temple space is, you know, it's a building, two-story hexagonal building, but the landscape and the grounds and the landscaping will get more beautiful with time. So we're working with the land, working with the plants to create even more beauty over time. And I love that idea of that kind of that collaboration with nature itself.
That's fantastic. And Tim, I hope that during this trip, I can see you in person, but thank you for being with us. And Richard, thank you. And look forward to Tim being on Richard's show. Richard's booked him already. Thanks, yes. Tim.
Thank you. Great to see you.
Dave, bye.
Awesome.